Hi, I'm Luke Dennis, the Development Director at WYSO. We are happy we can deliver these programs to you, people who listen on the web, and we rely on you to help us pay for this service. So at our website, wyso.org, click Support This Station and help keep these services coming. And thank you.
Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and I'd like to welcome to the program today Dennis McFarland. His new novel is Nostalgia. Hello, welcome to the program.
Thanks very much. Glad to be here.
Dennis, I had no idea that nostalgia meant something very different at one time than what I thought it meant. How did you discover this?
You know, I don't remember exactly how I discovered it, but, you know, I mean, it was in my research. I came across the ancient Greek derivation of it one day, and I do remember that whatever day I made that discovery was the day I thought that's going to be the title of my book, because the two Greek roots mean return home and pain, and it just had this nice double entendre for me, because the book looks back 150 years, but it also happens to be the clinical term that was used in the 19th century for what we call today post-traumatic stress disorder.
And we're coming up on the 150th anniversary next year of a terrible Civil War battle called the Battle of the Wilderness. And that's where your protagonist, Summerfield Hayes, encounters nostalgia.
Yeah, that's his first, when he joins the Union Army and goes off to the winter headquarters in Brandy Station, after, you know, wintering there and going through training, his first experience in the spring with combat is in the Battle of the Wilderness, and that was one of, you know, it was a very brutal battle. It was the first battle in Grant's Overland campaign, and, you know, the change that Grant brought to the Army of the Potomac was that he no longer withdrew, you know, after a battle if it was a loss or a draw. He just kept pushing forward, and he was willing to sacrifice, you know, any number of lives to keep moving forward.
And he's also a baseball player, Summerfield Hayes, and
yeah,
I didn't realize that baseball was really a sport during the Civil War. This was news to me.
It was a sport, and I mean, it was actually developing right before the war into the sport, you know, to the sort of professional sport that we would recognize today. You know, professional clubs were springing up, especially in the New York, Massachusetts area. And what the war had a kind of a balancing effect in a way, because it slowed things down in baseball by, you know, decimating baseball clubs. The players would, you know, put on the army uniform and go off to war. And yet at the same time, by going off to war as baseball players, they spread the game to portions of the country and to, you know, other soldiers who weren't already familiar with it.
And Summerfield is a star pitcher for what was the famous club in Brooklyn at that time, called the Eckford Club.
Yeah, the Eckford Club of Brooklyn. Mm-hmm.
And you have this wonderful, nostalgic baseball match that kind of starts the book, and we get flashbacks to it throughout the book. I love the archaic language that you unearthed for describing the play and the game.
Yeah, there was... apparently, one of the things that had actually changed right around the time that the book is set was that no longer did baseball players throw the ball at a base runner to get him out.
Mm-hmm.
No longer were they plunking base runners with the ball, which was called back in those days, I think, soaking.
Uh-huh.
Around this time, players started to consider it kind of infantile to do that.
So poor Summerfield gets in this battle, and he's there with his friends, guys who played in this ball game with him, and we get a lot of flashbacks to the battle, because something really terrible happens to Summerfield. I don't know if you want to say much about what happens, but if you want to set the scene for our listeners, that'd be great.
Yeah, I think I can talk about it, you know, without really including any spoilers. What happens to Summerfield Hayes is that very quickly and in a completely unpredictable way, his experience of battle in the wilderness makes him kind of lose his marbles a little bit, really. And now his experience in battle isn't just ordinary battle, you know, along the lines of, you know, one side firing at another side, because one of the chief qualities of the Battle in the Wilderness was that it was fought in what is essentially a jungle, and you couldn't see where the enemy was, and the woods filled up with smoke, and the woods caught fire, and it was a particularly horrendous battle, and his experience was particularly horrendous. And it affected him in a way with symptoms that today, you know, we would call PTSD and traumatic brain injury. He goes mute he's temporarily mute, he's temporarily deaf, and he eventually finds his way to a military hospital in Washington.
And it's a miracle that he finds his way, because the carnage around him is just so extreme. I mean, you captured the horrors of Civil War battle. It was appalling.
It was appalling. I mean, that was one of the, you know, I wasn't a Civil War buff of any kind, nor a historian, when I started doing the research to write this book. And one of the things that I was really impressed by was the appalling nature of the war. You know, it was almost like spree killing in places. You know, just the extraordinary death toll. Some of your listeners are probably aware of this statistic already, but if the death rate of the Civil War were applied to today's population, it would mean that we fought a war on our own land here that claimed 6 million lives.
Hmm.
It gives you an idea of truly how appalling it was. And one of the seeds of the story for me was that when I first started doing research about PTSD and the history of PTSD, I came across a fact about the history that during the Civil War, that sometimes the so-called quote-unquote crazy soldiers would just be turned loose on the battlefield and left to find their own way home. And I found that very moving and heartbreaking. And that became one of the seeds of the story for me. And that's what happens to him.
And the ones that were fortunate enough to somehow survive and get back to a hospital, as soon as they recovered even slightly, a lot of them were sent right back, weren't they?
Oh, yeah. There's the surgeon in chief of the hospital where Summerfield Hayes ends up convalescing. It's one of his complaints is that this commission comes through on a regular basis and, you know, determines who's ready to go back, and routinely they send soldiers back while they're still either too sick to really, you know, function, or before their injuries have sufficiently healed.
Dennis McFarland joins us. His book is Nostalgia. We do get just a couple of isolated glimpses of the enemy, the Confederate soldiers, and just based on these little snapshots, one gets the sense that it must have been far worse to be one of them.
Yeah, it was. I mean, in just in terms of sheer statistics, it was worse. The death toll in the Confederacy was higher than it was in the Union Army, and they weren't as well equipped in any way, not with weapons, not with rations, you know, in every other way, in every possible way. I mean to say they had it worse.
So Summerfield survives this hellish battle of the wilderness, and he's now convalescing in this hospital where he can't speak. He's apparently incapable of writing. His hands shake.
Yeah.
They don't know who he is.
Right.
And he's gone from one version of hell to another.
Well, he really has. I mean, when he was, you know, left to find his way to the hospital, there was, you know, part of his plight and part of any similar soldier's plight would always be that he would be taken for a deserter. And, of course, if he's captured as a deserter, he's going to be shot. And so when he does end up at the hospital, there are still, you know, some people on the staff there who suspect him of faking his illness to get out of fighting, not so much suspected as being a deserter as being a malingerer.
And then we have all that tension that exists because Summerfield's sister back in Brooklyn didn't want him to enlist. She and Summerfield lost their parents in a, right. in a tragedy, and he's very close to his sister.
Yeah.
And she doesn't know where he is.
Right. Well, once he, you know, for lack of a better phrase, once he loses his marbles, he's no longer... And he no longer has the capacity to write to her or let her know anything about what's going on. So there's quite a long period in which she just assumes that he's dead because she hasn't heard from him.
And for those of us who know our poetic history, a character appears in the hospital, and most of us recognize who he is. And he's quite an interesting character. He tries to hijack the story for a while, doesn't he?
Yes, which was really very much his personality in real life, I think. I mentioned in the author's note that this is on the flap of the book again, so you know it's not a spoiler. The person that you're referring to is Walt Whitman, who really did, of course, he was in the capacity he called soldier's missionary. He's often portrayed as a nurse in the military hospitals during the war, but he wasn't actually a nurse. He did apparently help with some wound dressing, but mostly what he did was he visited with the soldiers, and at, you know, great cost to his own health, he was in those hospitals every day, visiting with the men, bringing them small gifts, writing letters for them, reading to them, and just talking with them and cheering them up. And apparently it was very good medicine for an awful lot of them.
You do a lovely job of portraying the way that the impact of war has changed these men in this hospital. And you have this guy in the bed next to Summerfield who's lost a limb. And he's a wonderful character. We really feel sorry and sympathetic for him. He's always talking to his missing limb.
Yeah, he treats it as a baby and kind of cradles it, and he'll sing to it and so forth, yeah. Which I think was resourceful of him. I think that it was, you know, a lot of the soldiers are doing what they can to cope, uh-huh. you know, and it's a coping mechanism.
And then we have all the corruption going on around in the hospital. There's an orderly who is up to stuff, and... Then we have this silent guy who shows up who looks like he's asleep, but he's not.
That's the guy that ends up being in the bed next to Summerfield Hayes, is that?
Well,
oh, he just doesn't speak.
The guy who doesn't speak very much.
Yeah, yeah. Raw is his name. It's spelled R-A-U-G-H. Yeah.
Yeah, he's ever watchful, though.
I believe he's the character who everybody remarks looks like Abraham Lincoln.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
That's the guy.
He's ever watchful, but uh-huh. doesn't speak.
So we go back and forth. He's lying in the bed, and he's dreaming about things. He's going back into the battle in his mind. He's going back to that baseball game in his mind. Mm-hmm. How did you conceive of this? How did this come about? In the structure in your mind as you were creating this?
You know, honestly, Vic, I'm not sure how it seems to me that the structure and that sort of way that it proceeds forward by going, you know, two steps forward and one step back and moves around in time and so forth, it just was kind of like a part of the writing from the very beginning, and it wasn't something I really gave much thought to. It was just sort of how it unfolded for me in my own mind and how it started getting onto paper. The way that the book in general started for me was that I became very interested in the veterans of our contemporary wars who were coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan with PTSD, which is still an enormous problem. I just recently heard, you know, that every single day today, 22 of these veterans commit suicide in our country. And so I wanted to write something about that. And in the process of, and so I started reading up on it, and in the process of doing the research, I came across these, you know, these histories of the condition. And I thought if I were to move my story, I thought I was going to write something contemporary, but if I moved it back in time to the Civil War, I might have an opportunity to say something classical about this problem, as opposed to it seeming like I was writing a novel on a topical issue.
Well, it really has the quality of a fever dream. It's like he's having a fever dream, and that's kind of the way that the story feels to me as a reader. And I also got the sense that this could have been written 100 years ago. There's a timelessness to it.
Ah, I like the sound of that. I didn't make any kind of an attempt to duplicate 19th century prose, because that would have been odd. But on the other hand, I did adopt some usages and some, you know, nomenclature and vocabulary from the time. And I, in my sort of OCD way, I made certain that I didn't use any words in this narrative that didn't exist in 1864.
Oh.
So, you know, it's kind of, as is often the case with voice in fiction, it's kind of sleight of hand. It kind of suggests an earlier time, but if you were to actually analyze it, you would see that it didn't really duplicate the way people wrote or the way people spoke back in those days. I think that would be too hard to read, you know, to the contemporary ear. Mm-hmm. We wouldn't buy it. It would affect suspension of disbelief, I think.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
The book is Nostalgia by Dennis McFarlane, and I have to confess it's the first of your books that I've read, but now I want to go back and read some others. I see that you've written a number of novels. Tell us about yourself. How did you become a writer? What have you been doing?
Well, this is my seventh book, and honestly, when I was a young person, I graduated with a BA degree in musical composition. I thought that was, you know, I was going to pursue some kind of a career in that area. And by the time I graduated, I realized that I didn't really want to anymore. And I was about 25 years old and felt, you know, what a lot of 25-year-olds feel, which is, what am I going to do with my life? And I was feeling a little bit desperate. And I recalled that back in high school, both in high school and in college, I'd had English teachers who had said to me that I could be a writer if I wanted to, just based on papers that I wrote. And so I gathered that I must have some kind of a talent for that. And so I started writing short stories and just basically taught myself to write by imitating writers that I consider to be the masters. And it was a long time before, it was quite a long time. I mean, I started at the age of 25. I didn't publish my first novel until the age of 40. So, you know, it's a pretty long apprenticeship,
I'll say.
Yeah. On the other hand, the arc of my career has been that I tend to start at the top. So that first novel that I wrote, which was called The Music Room, was a New York Times bestseller. Oh. And the first published short story, my first short story that was published, was published in The New Yorker.
Wow. That's
which, you know, is a great thing, but it does make everything that comes after it seem as if you're sort of working your way down rather than continue to work your way up.
Right. It's like the curse of the Oprah book.
Yeah, I reckon. Right.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Once you have the Oprah book, nothing you do ever again is ever going to be as good.
Yes, which, of course, has nothing to do with the quality of the work.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, it's funny, but by a weird coincidence, we just finished taping an interview with a novelist who's married to a poet, and I understand that you're a novelist who's married to a poet, and that your wife is the one who put you onto the fact that Walt Whitman spent all this time in hospitals.
Yeah, that's right. My wife is Michelle Blake, and she is a poet. She's also a writer. She's published three mystery novels. When I was telling her about my idea for the book, to move it back into the Civil War era, she said, well, you do know that Walt Whitman worked in the hospitals, in the military hospitals during the war. And I didn't know that, but that was a very important moment for me, because I realized that if I could make Walt Whitman a central character in my story, then this was a book I felt all the more enthusiastic about writing. And he was a great character for me, by the way. He just really produced a great payoff once I had read some biographies, and even more importantly, read his own memoranda from the war. I just felt like I knew him. I felt like I knew what he looked like and what he would sound like and just the kind of person that he would be.
He really does come alive. And I was a little dubious when you first brought in this guy named Walt. I thought, oh, wait a minute, it's got to be him, but can he really do it? And he really did come off like you kind of thought he should.
Yeah, I mean, if there's any kind of a flaw there, it's that I struggled to make him, how can I say, I couldn't, it was as if his spirit was controlling me and making sure that he would only be seen in the best possible light as a character, which was also like him, you know. I mean, he was very modern, and one of the ways that he was modern was that he was self-promoting. And, you know, he would write reviews of Leaves of the Grass and publish them in publications that, you know, under a different name. And he had sent the book to Emerson, and when Emerson wrote a complimentary letter back to him, he published the letter, which was never Emerson's intention.
Oh.
And I just, you know, he comes across, I think, in my book as rather angelic. And every attempt I made to darken him was just, you know, one of those moments in a historical novel that sort of seemed to stick out like a sore thumb as a moment of research. And so somehow he does come off as angelic, but I honestly think that he was pretty angelic.
The book is Nostalgia. Dennis McFarland is the author. He joins us on the program today. I think the most amazing thing about the story is, if you had told me before reading it that I would continue to be really interested in a story where so much of it takes place with a guy flat on his back in a bed,
right,
I would have said no way.
Yeah.
And yet somehow you keep it moving, you keep it going, and it's really a page turner.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. I mean, I knew that I was presenting myself with a challenge, because Summerfield Hayes really is the point of view character in this book. And, every step of the way. So earlier when you said something about it seeming like a fever dream, I think that's because my allegiance to his point of view is so strong throughout the story. And and I knew that once I got him to the hospital and he was going to be lying in a bed unable to speak, that what I had was a point of view character who never said anything and who wasn't going to speak for, you know, many, many pages. And that presented a challenge. But fortunately, along with Walt, you know, I just think the cast of characters at the hospital are interesting and compelling enough that his observing them and his hearing their dialogue with each other and so forth, made it possible to bring it off.
And Walt does a really good job of channeling what he thinks some of these convalescing patients are thinking or wanting.
Yes, that's right. And, you know, I couldn't begin to tell you where I came across this idea, but somewhere I read that his empathy was so strong with these young men that it really was almost to the point of clairvoyance. So he is, you know, extremely intuitive about seeming to understand what they're feeling and what they need at any given moment and so forth. It's another one of his angelic qualities.
And without revealing any spoilers, I would love our listeners to know that this is also a story of forbidden love.
Yeah. Are you going to stop there?
I'm going to stop there unless you want to go further.
Well, I mean, again, I don't think that it's really revealing, I don't think that it is in the nature of a spoiler to say that one of the chief motivating factors in Summerfield's decision to enlist in the Army is that the sudden death of their parents has thrown him and his sister, you know, together in a very, very close way at a time when he himself was coming of age as a young man, and he's getting confused about his feelings for his very beautiful, very smart, and arresting sister, Sarah. And he thinks that by going off to war, he can, you know, get that sorted out in his head.
And later on, after he's recovering from all the horrors that he's been through, when he finally discovers that his sister, not knowing what's become of him, has become engaged, this mm-hmm. drives him mad.
Oh, yeah. Yes, indeed.
Was that a spoiler? I'm sorry.
A little bit of a spoiler, but I don't, you know, I think anybody who actually went out and bought the book and started reading would certainly have forgotten that by the time they're getting to it.
Okay. How long did it take you to write?
Probably by the time I actually started doing the actual writing, it was about 3 years. And then there was another couple of years before that of, you know, getting ready to write it. The research was formidable for me because I don't have a scholarly mind. I'm not a historian. I started out here as a person who didn't even have much of a working knowledge of the Civil War. So I had to learn all of that. And what I wasn't prepared for was that, you know, there's sort of four major inquiries, areas of inquiry, you know, that I had to do for this book. One was the pioneer era of baseball. Mm-hmm. The other was Walt Whitman, the Battle of the Wilderness, and 19th century medicine. And that seemed doable to me, even though, you know, it was obviously I was going to have to read a lot of books. But what I wasn't prepared for was that pretty soon into the writing, I realized what I really had to learn was everything about everything, because all the stuff that we take for granted if we're writing a fictional scene in a contemporary setting, like what things look like, what people eat, how they dress, you know, what the hardware is, all that stuff was stuff that was unknown to me. So really, you know, I had to do a certain amount of research to start writing. But even after I was writing, I continued to have to do research really right up to the end of the book.
And I'll assume that you actually finished this book some time ago.
Yeah.
With the publishing process, the way it works. Is there another project that you're looking at now, some other novel that's starting to come to life?
I wish the answer was yes, but it is not. You know, I'm at the stage I always call as the well filling up again.
Oh.
Because after a project like this, I always feel very, you know, empty. And it'll take a while before I know what I want to do next. And right now, I'm sort of in that mode where everything I see and hear is you know, I scan it for the possibility of it being my next subject.
Oh.
But no, nothing has coalesced for me yet.
Well, we really appreciate your time today.
That was wonderful. That was the best interview I've done. Thank you. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to The Book Nook. The book is Nostalgia by Dennis McFarland. For The Book Nook, I'm Vic McInnes. Next week, tune in for Jocelyn Jackson. We'll be talking to her about her new novel. It's called Someone Else's Love Story. And we'll also tell you how you can meet her. She's going to be coming through Dayton and doing a book signing for this new book. And it's all right here in the Book Nook. The Book Nook is recorded at Soundspace in Yellow Springs and engineered by Chris Hertzler.